Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Today on The Spot, we're going to do something we've never done before. Listen to four stories in under 30 minutes. So let's just dive right in. There are a lot of podcasts that act like radio shows, producing multiple segments to include in just one episode, and Side Door is one of the best. Produced by the Smithsonian, Side Door tells stories about science, art, history, humanity, and where they unexpectedly overlap. It's like a quick tour of some of the most interesting people and exhibits within the Smithsonian organization, produced just for your ears. Take a listen.
This is Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian. I'm Tony Cohn.
And I'm Megan Dietrich.
In this episode, we're talking about identity. Our identities help us understand ourselves and find our people. We build them through life experiences. It's our careers, our geographies, and our community. We preserve them in family histories and religious beliefs. Dr. Jeanetta Cole has spent her life exploring the meaning of identity, first as an anthropologist, and now as the director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African Art. Visual art, she says, can help visitors understand the diversity of a place like Africa, but also the many ways an individual can self-identify as African. But our identity isn't just one thing. How we see ourselves has a huge role in how we see others around us. We sat with Jeanetta in her office and chatted about just that. She's one of the most dynamic speakers at the Smithsonian, so I'm just going to let her lay it out for you uninterrupted.
When we use the word identity, I think the most thought about way that we are communicating an idea is this: identity is who I am. But I must say that as an anthropologist, certainly as a museum director here at the National Museum of African Art, and as a human, I have trouble with identity when it is used in singular terms. I think this world of ours would be so much better if we always thought about, interacted with others in terms of our multiple identities. Think about what's going on now in our world. The kind of divisiveness, the insistence that some folk shouldn't be here or some folk aren't good enough to be there. And we then characterize someone in singular terms. That's a Black person. That's a Muslim. While each of us, I think, may well have a primary identity, a way in which we sort of think of ourselves most often, or perhaps most strongly, but we are many identities. I am an African-American woman. In terms of class, probably got to go to upper middle class. In terms of sexual orientation, heterosexual. In terms of ability or disability, well, depends on if my knee is kicking up or not, if I'm going to say I'm fully able. In terms of religion, in terms of age, in terms of nationality, all of those specific identities come together. But you know, I have other identities. I'm a mom. I'm a grandmom. I'm a wife. I'm a colleague. I'm a museum director. I'm an anthropologist. So I can be victimized because I am African American or a woman or both. But when I claim all of my identities, including being heterosexual, I could turn and victimize somebody else based on their sexual orientation. When we become more thoughtful about and understand the centrality of identity and how identities capture who we are, we can actually make a great contribution toward dealing with one of the greatest problems in our world. It's called bigotry and discrimination.
Today we have two more stories of identity. One identity that is being kept alive in the face of terror, and one that was built to bring power to an invisible community. Identity is more than just who you are. It's also who you aren't. In the late 1970s, some lesbian feminists decided that instead of arguing about equality within marriage, childcare, or lower pay, they'd remove themselves from the fight entirely. Rather than work to change a society that didn't represent them, several thousand women in North America decided to create their own separate society. My co-host Megan brings you the story of one of these women and the world that she set out to create.
Joan Byron, sometimes called Jeb, spent her career as a photographer and filmmaker documenting lesbian communities and progressive movements, starting in the 1970s. We're interviewing Joan at her bungalow just outside of D.C. Now in her 70s, Joan is an absolute spark.
Okay, girls, that's it. Finish. You're not coming over here, so chill.
Within minutes of our arrival, she's shushed the dogs barking in the yard, cracked jokes about her flannel shirt, and ushered us inside. On her porch, she's left out this plate of water with a sponge in it for bees. She says bees are dying out, and with this, at least they have a safe place to drink. It's easy to see how she was able to shoot such intimate, vulnerable photographs of women. The truth is, when you meet her, you want her to like you very badly.
For lesbians in particular, we really were invisible at the time that I came out, which is why I decided to become a visual artist and a visual activist, because I needed to see myself and others like me.
Joan authored two groundbreaking collections of photography. Catherine Ott, a curator at the Smithsonian's Museum of American History, says the work had a huge impact on young lesbians. Catherine is researching these overlooked moments in LGBTQ history, including a time when lesbians forged new societies and even religions.
So many women who were questioning found her portraiture, her books, portraits of lesbians, was the first time you could see what gay women look like, really.
As a documentary filmmaker, Joan knows how to create an opening scene. And we begin our chat with a quiet ritual, lighting a candle and imbuing a crystal with our intentions for the interview.
Usually there would be a blessing.
It's akin to the sort of thing she would have done back in her coven. Yep, coven. Back in the 1970s, Joan was part of a group of women who created their own religion.
So I'm picking up the big crystal, and I'm holding it to put good energy and an intention for the interview we're about to do for a new podcast. And my name is Joan Byron.
Actually, religion was just one aspect of the movement Joan was a part of. The separatist movement was made up of feminists, many of them lesbians, who tried to create a new world where they could live entirely separate from men.
Separatism gets a very bad rap, and primarily it gets a bad rap from people who have been centered in society and in theory and in conversations forever. So they don't understand why identity is important, because their identity is sort of the default identity.
This was all happening as women were organizing and demanding new roles in society. But lesbians often found themselves silenced within the feminist movement.
Well, the most painful reaction was that many of us had been part of the women's liberation movement in D.C. And when we came out as lesbians, we were purged from that group. They felt that we were a big threat to women's liberation, both on a personal level and on the level that a feminist movement that was struggling to get credibility in the mainstream would be tainted by the lavender herring of having lesbians as part of their movement.
So they started their own movement by starting their own society. And they weren't alone. Separatists formed collectives all across America, from farms to publishing houses to women's-only music festivals. They called communes women's lands. And even the word women got scrutiny. They'd spell it with a Y. You know, keeping the man out.
When your identity is invisible or marginalized, you have to figure out a way to both be yourself, which helps to have other people with you who are like you, and make other people see that you are not like them. So that's why we formed this lesbian feminist separatist collective.
They called it the Furies. Made up of 12 women who lived and worked together in two houses in Washington, D.C., they pooled incomes and split chores, published a separatist newspaper. The goal was complete autonomy.
And it seemed at the time, and I still believe this, even though I'm no longer a separatist, is that it's important to have a period where you do figure out what your identity is and figure out a way to convey that to other people with like identities and to people who are different than you.
For 2 years, the collective and its newspaper shaped the discussion of lesbians' place in society. They wanted to dismantle societal confines and change politics, capitalism, and yes, spirituality, to fit them. The religion that Joan and other lesbians created was one that left behind what they saw as patriarchal traditions.
I say Dianic Wiccan religion because if I said we were witches and pagans, it would freak you out a little more. But we were. At the time I became a witch, we were reimagining and reinventing everything. And if you know anything about culture, you know most cultures have some religion. To have a spiritual dimension was very important.
This religion, Catherine says, made Joan and her contemporaries feel seen, at least amongst themselves.
They made music and sang together. They borrowed from Native American concepts and practices, from pagans, from ancient goddess rituals and wisdom, from all over the place, to create a new world, basically, a woman-identified world.
Joan is donating some of the artifacts of her coven, including the crystal, to the Smithsonian's Museum of American History as part of a collection on spirituality. Here's Catherine again.
People know about the Stonewall riots often as being really important and often pointed to as the beginning of the gay liberation movement. But I would say that what's happening in the 70s with queer women is just as important. There is history of people that is undocumented or hidden and invisible, and there are populations that have never been given respect or recorded. And when you don't have the evidence, people can say it never happened. As a museum, if we have archival materials, we have letters, we have objects to show, no, it did happen. These are things that real people used, and this is how they used them, and this is what they thought they were doing. So it's not only important as evidence, but it's people's lives that we're collecting. We can't collect them, although I'd like to.
Through community, culture, and religion, lesbians helped create new ways to talk about identity, particularly queer identity. And with her photographs, Joan built lesbians a visual identity, a photographic history that gives thick, powerful roots to a formerly hidden community. Some identities are ones we consciously choose, but in many ways, our cultural identity creates us. We're shaped by the art and architecture and music that make up our heritage. So what do you do when the cornerstones of your identity are destroyed? That's what Syrians and Iraqis are facing today as militants from the Islamic State, commonly known as ISIS and ISIL, wipe out their heritage sites. Archaeologist Mustafa Fadali has come to Erbil, Iraq, one of the oldest continuously inhabited cities in the world, from his hometown of Nasiriyah. He's here to learn how to protect his country's heritage. That heritage, he says, is in crisis.
The greatest threat to our cultural heritage and destruction that Iraq is currently suffering from, and has ever suffered from in its entire history, is ISIS.
Thankfully, Mustafa isn't alone. In the last 9 years, the Iraqi Institute for the Conservation of Heritage and Antiquities has trained over 300 museum staff and archaeologists like Mustafa. Jessica Johnson, who's now the head of conservation at the Smithsonian's Museum Services Center, has been working with the Institute since it opened. Jessica says we may think of heritage sites as crucial parts of art and history, but ISIS sees them as perfect targets.
Right now, Daesh and ISIL are a big threat because they're using heritage for political reasons. They're going in and destroying sites or museums because those represent something about the history and the people of the country.
Islamic militants have attacked some of the best-preserved archaeological sites in the region. They've bulldozed ancient capitals, dynamited ruins, and rampaged through Iraq's second-largest museum in Mosul. And they aren't being driven by ideology alone. Archaeological looting has likely earned ISIS millions of dollars. But it's not just Iraqi's history that's being destroyed. It's ours, too.
History of Iraq is some of the earliest civilizations in the world. So the first people who learned to write in the same way we write now, the first people to tell stories, some of which are still told now, come from that region. It's so important to the understanding of civilization across the world now.
That's why Jessica is overseeing a course on emergency conservation. The goal is to help Iraqi archaeologists catch up on the tools and knowledge that they couldn't access during the rule of Saddam Hussein and the war that followed it. The students are learning methods to restore heritage sites that are purposefully damaged, but they're also being taught how to protect these places and collections from natural disasters.
Emergency conservation is responding to crisis, really. So it might be an earthquake, or the crisis might be looting and war and destruction.
They're stabilizing buildings, using satellite mapping to learn the precise scales and locations of sites, and documenting existing antiquities, all to create recovery plans.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
This is the last day of class.
The work that goes on in that kind of conservation is just trying to minimize the damage that's happening.
Hosher Hassan is a student at the Institute who works as a surveyor at archaeological sites.
Even if we aren't in danger of an attack from the Islamic State or the economic crisis, we face looting. So it's very important for us to document everything. That way, if things are taken in the future, we can identify everything that's been stolen. We have it already.
Iraq is home to numerous languages and religions, and the students here represent almost all of them. The class lets them collaborate and create networks of support they can take back home.
What other one? Was that
this building?
Interior?
Exterior.
Jessica says those ties and the tangible symbols of a shared heritage can help unify their country.
The heritage brings us together in different ways so that we don't just see ourselves as isolated people or isolated families. We have a broader understanding of what's important in the world and the way we look at the world.
Protecting heritage, even in conflict, is important, not only for the identity of Iraqis, but for the knowledge that lives with them and the legacy of our ancestors.
The podcast Side Door is produced for the Smithsonian by Megan Dietrich and Tony Cohen. See their full team and listen to the entire first season of the show at si.edu/sidedoor. You're tuned to The Spot, KALW's weekly showcase of the best stories from indie radio producers and podcasts. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Our final story this afternoon comes from the history podcast, The Memory Palace. In this episode, host Nate DeMayo introduces us to the identities within an out-of-this-world family.
This is The Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMayo. Charles Duke was 25 that spring when man first went to space. He was 26 when he met Dottie. He was on leave from the Air Force at MIT. He went there to get his degree in aeronautics and found out they also had something called astronautics. And it sounded cool. And so he did that too. Dottie was a secretary at Harvard Business School. They were both from the South. And they fell in love and complained together about the winter and were married in the spring. He got his master's, got into test pilot school at Edwards Air Force Base in California. Dottie liked the sound of California. Didn't think of the desert when she thought of California, though. Soon her husband was never around, and her days were all heat and dust and dashed dreams. Charlie was 29 when their first son was born, and when he saw this thing in the Sunday LA Times, front page, said NASA was looking for more astronauts for the Apollo program, for the moon. And that sounded cool. Sounded cooler to Dottie, who thought lugging a baby around Houston would be an upgrade over the Mojave Desert. Charlie was 31 when their second son was born. And Charlie was never around. He was training to be an astronaut. He loved all of it. Loved learning. Loved the long hours, the weeks away, studying geology in Oregon and Hawaii and Iceland and Alaska, jungle survival in Panama, learning how to troubleshoot the far ultraviolet spectrograph, how to perform a translunar injection, while his sons were learning to walk, how to make sure their lowercase j's dip beneath the line, like a fish hook, while his wife was learning to do everything, everything at the house, because her husband was never around, because her husband was an astronaut. Charlie Duke was 33 that summer when man first went to the moon. He was in mission control. His South Carolina lilt was the voice of Houston.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
As men he knew, co-workers, buddies, bounded on the moon.
That's one small step for man.
That was how things went for astronauts. You were assigned a mission and a role, and it meant that one man talked into a microphone while another walked on the moon. It meant that some families got the cover of Life magazine, got to meet the president, got that at least, in exchange for being without their father, their husband, for days and weeks at a time. Days and weeks that amounted to years. Dottie was in her early 30s when she started searching for something of her own, some sort of meaning outside of her marriage, in work, in smoking weed, and flirting with other men. She was a travel agent for a while. She liked that. She was good at that. Took trips to London, Africa even. But it was lonely, and there was a home to keep, and kids who needed help getting the chain back on their bike, finding the stuffed animal that got tangled up in the covers. And there was a husband who dreamt of the moon. Charlie Duke was 34 when he knew he was going. He was back up in Apollo 13. That meant he would pilot the landing module on Apollo 16. And that meant the moon. He was 36 when his turn came around. And his sons were old enough to notice that their dad was never around. And had seen enough rockets lift off. Seen enough smoke and fire and fathers and capsules catching the light as they shrank in the distance and disappeared into the black they were told lay just beyond the blue sky. To know to be scared. And so Charlie said he would take them with him. And so they got dressed for a family photograph. Charlie and Dottie sit on a bench in the lawn. He's in a yellow button-down. His pants match his tie. They're both that color that Crayola calls burnt sienna. She is in a seafoam green pantsuit and a blue cravat. It's 1972. And there are the boys. Big smiles. Who knows how many takes it took to get those smiles. The oldest, Charles, like his dad and his grandfather, is 7 years old, a big boy, hands in his pockets, standing tall in front. The youngest, 5-year-old Thomas, leans on both his parents. One hand's on his dad's thigh, one's on his mom's. Who knows how much longer he'll still reach for them like that at a moment like this. There in the snapshot. Charlie was 36 years, 6 months old, when he spent 71 hours on the moon. He collected rocks. That was the bulk of the mission of Apollo 16, learning about the moon. And that's basically what there is to learn about the moon, its composition and origins. That and what it feels like to be there, to leap 4 feet off the ground like it was nothing, to see the Earth moon-sized. At one point, Charlie asked his partner, John Young, the Neil Armstrong to his Buzz, or Buzz to his Neil, depending, how long he figured their footprints would be there on the surface, with no wind and no weather. Young thought about it, factored in all the things he knew about the moon, and he knew lots about the moon, and figured 4 billion years. 71 hours out of a life, then 36 years and 6 months long, now 80 and change. After all those hours in the classroom, in the simulator, in the field, in the office, in line at the cafeteria, away from his family. And in one of those hours, 240,000 nautical miles from home, one of the last hours on his business trip to the moon, Charlie took that family photo, wrapped in clear plastic, bent a little bit from the journey, and placed it in the dust near the lip of a crater. He liked the idea that someone would find it someday, probably pretty soon. Maybe he'd even come back for it. Maybe on one of the next missions. Maybe one of the scientists on the moon base they hoped to build in the 80s would find it. Maybe a colonist. Maybe one of his own sons on some vacation someday. He didn't know then that he wasn't going back to the moon. He didn't know then that we don't go to the moon anymore. But he liked the idea that his family was there, where they are still, and will be for something close to forever. A snapshot. 2 boys. A man, a woman. A moment in their lives.
Find more stories from Nate DiMeo at thememorypalace.us.
See that man there sitting alone? He's got no body, he's got no home. He wouldn't care if the world stopped today. If it did, all he would say, should have gone to the moon. Oh, he should have played in the stars above. Yeah.
That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org, and you'll find The Spot under the Programs tab. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, just drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. And thanks for listening. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Tune in next Sunday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on 91.7 KALW, San Francisco.